All right. Thank you very much for the invitation to speak. I will be talking, in the last year and a half or so, a little more, I've written a few papers on this topic. Here they are with Shai Chester, Sheehan, Damon Binder, and Yifan Wang. And today I will talk about them, but I'll focus mostly on this one that I wrote with Damon, Shai, and Yifan. So, well, I realize that here people aren't really thinking about this stuff. So, you know, please ask questions. If things are unclear, if I should explain some things more. And also I thought that because of that, maybe I can start with the main messages that I want to convey. And the first one is that so this is sort of the punchline of the talk, unfortunately. So in recent years, there's been a lot of progress calculating holographic correlators. By that, I mean calculating Witten diagrams. And what I find interesting about it is that this is so one can calculate these Witten diagrams even when the interaction vertices are not completely known. And this is what I'll explain. And the other thing is that, as some of the people here I'm sure know, there's a connection between holographic correlators and scattering amplitudes in flat space. By taking a certain limit of the correlator, one can arrive at a flat space scattering amplitude. Looking at CFT correlators in theories where we understand very well the holographic dual, like N equal 4 Supriang-Mills, then one can get scattering amplitudes in string theory, say massless closed-string states, or M theory. And we've been doing this for the last year and a half, and we reproduced many of the results that were about scattering amplitudes, string scattering amplitudes, or graviton scattering in 11D that were computed using worldsheet methods. We haven't been able to get anything beyond what people knew. There's a good reason for that. But you know, it's useful to keep in mind this way as, you know, as an alternative to worldsheet computations. So let me put this in a little bit more in context. The ATS-CFT correspondence, which is sort of what's underlying this talk, has been used historically in two ways. One of them is to learn about quantum gravity or string theory or M theory from conformal field theory. And the other way has been to learn about strongly interacting quantum field theories using the bulk. Each way has its own challenges. The first one, where we're trying to learn about gravity or string theory or M theory from the CFT, has the challenge that the CFTs that we're talking about are usually strongly coupled, so the calculations in the CFT are almost always impossible. And the challenge for the second thing, learning about QFTs from the bulk, is that while one can do this at the level of supergravity or gravity in the bulk, not much is known about string theory or M theory in N2 de Sury space beyond the supergravity approximation. And actually, not much has been done beyond tree level also. So what will I talk about in this talk? I will use various techniques, analytic bootstrap, supersymmetric localization, to do precisely this, to explore ADS-CFT beyond the supergravity approximation. And as I said on the previous slide, even though there'll be nothing new that I'll say today about string theory or M theory, scattering amplitudes, this talk will have new results on holographic correlators, so we'll have new results about the CFT. But, you know, if one pushes this method a little further, then perhaps one can learn new things about graviton scattering amplitudes, for instance, in M theory. Okay. So what are the examples of AdS-CFT that I'll be talking about? Talk about the most well-established ones, the duality between 4D, N equal 4 super Anmils theory with SUN gauge group, a large N and large Tuft coupling. Tuft coupling is G Anmils squared N, and which is dual to type 2B string theory on AdS 5 times S5. And if I have time at the end, I'll also mention some results involving the duality between the 3D ABJM theory at large N and M theory on AdS 4 times S7 mod ZK. So I'll focus on the N equal 4 super Anmils case for most of the talk, since probably this is the one that's more familiar to people. And also some of the formulas are actually simpler in this case. So, okay. So as I said before, the idea is to compute holographic correlators, even in the cases when the bulk interaction vertices are not known. So the idea is that holographic correlators are simple in Mellin space. And you can ask, what do I mean by simple? What do I mean by Mellin space? By simple, I mean that the answer can be bootstrapped. So the holographic correlators obey some general properties, and just knowing the properties, we can more or less figure out what the answer is. Maybe we actually need to do some calculation, but we can figure out most of the answer. And another thing that holographic correlators satisfy, and this goes back to work that was done here about 20 years ago, is that there's a certain limit of CFT correlators, which is a flat space limit, from which one can recover scattering amplitudes in flat space. So the idea would be, so this is AdS space, it looks like a cylinder. The idea would be to create some wave packets, and those wave packets would scatter somewhere in the center of AdS and then go back to the boundary. And if the energy of the wave packets is bigger than the curvature scale of AdS, then much bigger, then the curvature is not going to matter. So one can take a limit in which one obtains a scattering amplitude in flat space. And of course, a process like this will have an interpretation via AdS-CFT in terms of a CFT correlator. So from the CFT correlator, we'd be able to relate that to the scattering amplitude in flat space. As I said, this goes back to these papers from the late 90s. A very concrete proposal for how to do this was in this paper by Pinedonis. I'll explain that. All right, so this is an example. So suppose that on the boundary we have four operators, O sub I, with, for simplicity, equal scaling dimensions, delta I equals delta, and we consider a four-point function of these operators. Now, it's a conformal field theory, so conformal invariance implies that the four-point function has this overall prefactor that takes care of the overall scaling dimension of these operators, and then it's an arbitrary function of U and V, where U and V are the cross ratios that we can form out of the four points that are invariant under conformal transformations. So in order to specify what the four-point function is, we just have to say what this function G of U and V is. Now, equivalently, we can say what the Mellin transform of the function G of U and V is. So the Mellin transform is defined as follows. If we take the connected part of the correlator, we can write as an integral over two variables that I'll call little s and little t. And so there's some prefactor. It's not going to be very important. U and V appear here. So it's U is raised to some power that depends on s. And V also raised to some power that depends on S and T. So here I also introduced this parameter U, which is related to S and T by this relation. So S plus T plus U is 4 times delta. And then in the definition of the Mellin transform, there's some gamma functions. And then there's a Mellin amplitude over here, M of S and T. So if we know M of S and T, we can do this integral and can calculate G. If we know G, there's a similar formula through which we can calculate M of S and T. So knowing M and knowing G is the same thing. The integration contour in these integrals, as well as in many of the integrals that will be in this talk, runs parallel to the imaginary axis. So if the integration contour is confusing, consider this possibility, if it will be less confusing. All right. So what's good about this definition is that what's good about it is that the Mellin amplitude for Witten diagrams, for contact Witten diagrams or exchange Witten diagrams, is very simple and has nice properties. So, oh, by the way, I should say that you know, I denoted these variables by S and T, and there's also U. So this is similar to the Mandelstam invariants, S, T, and U in flat space. And there's, that's no accident, because this, these S, T, and U's will be related to the Mandelstam invariants. And I'll show that in a couple slides.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah, sure.
S plus T plus U is usually 4m squared. And here you have 4 delta.
Yeah.
Delta is not m squared. Maybe yes.
Delta is not m squared.
Right. Delta is m. So yeah. Is there some conversion factor that I should think of? How to think about S, T, and U as proper variables that do add to mass squared?
I am not sure. I'm not sure. In fact, you'll see in a couple slides, but the flat space limit is the limit where S, T, and U are large. And in that limit, what's on the right-hand side is not going to matter much, so this is going to be approximately zero. And that's just because I'll be describing scattering of massless particles in flat space.
Sure. I'm more concerned about delta, I
think. These are dimensionless versions of the Mandelstam variables where you divide out by angle mass squared.
Yeah. There could be... Well, okay.
No, these, my concern is that it's delta on the right-hand yeah. side and not delta yeah. squared.
Yeah,
the thing that's mass is delta, no?
Yeah.
S plus T plus U is M squared.
Well, probably the shortest answer is that these things are not the Mandelstam variants, and they don't have to obey S plus T plus U.
You're crossing to them as if they were, right?
Yeah, but that just follows from this equation, from this definition and the crossing of the CFT correlator. Mm-hmm. Okay, so what are the properties? So when it comes to Witten diagrams, we have contact with diagrams, or we have exchange diagrams, or we have loop diagrams, or diagrams with more loops, and so on. So the main properties are that the contact Witten diagrams, so these are things like this, they give Mellin amplitudes that are polynomial in S and T, and the degree of the polynomial is the number of derivatives in the interaction vertex divided by 2. You know, if it were to think about scattering amplitudes, the scattering amplitudes for some interaction vertex with derivatives would also be a homogeneous polynomial in the Mandelstam invariants of this particular degree. So, you know, the Witten diagrams will have more information than the scattering amplitudes. Now, the exchange Witten diagrams are diagrams like this, also tree-level. They give Mellin amplitudes with poles. So, for example, if we have the S-channel scalar exchange, this gives poles, these particular values of S where that are related to the dimension of the operator dual to the field that's being exchanged. In this talk, I won't discuss loops, so we can just stop at these two properties. Okay? And now the flat space limit that I described, that I mentioned before, this is the relation. So we take the Mellin amplitude. So if we want to compute the scattering amplitude at some values of the Mandelstam invariants, capital S and capital T, then we take the Mellin amplitude, we evaluate it L squared S over 2 alpha and L squared T over 2 alpha, where L is the radius of ADS. And then we put these extra factors that depend on alpha, and then we do this integral, and then we take the L go into infinity limit. And that would be the scattering amplitude. So this is the formula that was written down by Pentadonis, and then it was proven using this wave packet construction by Fitzpatrick and Kaplan. So this scattering amplitude I'm talking about is the scattering amplitude of massless particles in flat space. That's just because if we keep the dimension of the operator fixed and we take L to infinity, then the mass of the particles goes to zero in the flat space limit. So all I'll be discussing in this talk is scattering amplitudes of massless particles like gravitons in 10D and 11D. So here, SD and U are the Mandelstam invariants. OK, so what this formula implies is that because we're evaluating this M at L squared times something and L squared times something, and then we take L to infinity, that is just the leading term at large L, at large arguments of this M that contributes to the flat space scattering amplitude. So this formula implies that M of S and T at leading order in large S and T, by little s and little t, these would be the arguments of M. This would be proportional to the flat space scattering amplitude. What this integral actually does is just, the numerical coefficient is different, and it just fixes the numerical coefficient. So in particular, this Mellin amplitude has the same growth at large s and t as the flat space scattering amplitude. So for example, if we're interested in a scattering amplitude in gravity, that's a two-derivative theory. So then the Mellin amplitude would grow linearly with S and T. If we think about an interaction vertex that has eight derivatives, then the Mellin amplitude would grow like the fourth power of S and T. Okay. So now if we do this procedure in a realistic example, or by which I mean an example that comes from string theory, like N equal 4 Supreme Mills, so we keep the dimension of the operators fixed and then send L to infinity in this way, we would get a scattering amplitude in 10 dimensions with the momenta restricted to d plus 1. Well, in that case, it would be to 5 of the 10 dimensions. There would be no momenta in the other 5 dimensions. But for a 4-point scattering amplitude, that's it gives the most general answer.
So let's say the scattering just takes place in 5 dimensions?
In 5 dimensions out of the 10, yeah. Yeah. But, you know, if you have a scattering process in 10 dimensions, you can always find a five-dimensional, four particles, you can always find a five-dimensional subspace where that scattering is contained. This, of course, would be a shortcoming when we go to more and more particles. But I'm not going to do that, so it won't be a shortcoming in this talk.
But this is still a low-energy limit in the flat space limit, right?
In 10 dimensions?
Yes.
Yes, so this would be, as I'll show you, this would be a low energy limit. That's right. That's absolutely correct. Yeah?
Is it known how to, if I want to get a massive version of this, how to take delta to infinity as L goes to infinity?
Yeah, there are some proposals. I haven't really studied them in detail, but there are some proposals.
Yeah, then my problem comes back again, the S plus D plus.
Well, I was wondering, one way of solving that is to let delta goes to infinity as fast as L squared.
Yeah.
Because then M squared would go like delta.
Yeah, the proposals would have to involve that.
Now we solve that problem.
Yeah, so you just look at the family of operators, and then you take a limit where delta increases as you take L to infinity. Yeah, okay, good. So now that I told you what the properties of the Mellin amplitudes are, then the procedure for computing the holographic correlators should be simple. So instead of doing the complicated Witten diagram computations, instead of that, we can use the properties of the Mellin amplitudes, the analytic structure, the growth, a large S and T, if we know what kind of vertex they're coming from, the crossing symmetry that follows from the crossing symmetry of the CFT correlator, supersymmetry of their supersymmetry, determine the Mellin amplitudes for contact and exchange written diagrams. And what this procedure does, it determines the Mellin amplitudes up to a few numerical constants that we would then have to calculate. The number of constants grows with the number of derivatives that we have in the interaction vertex. So for a small number of derivatives in the interaction vertex, it might be possible with a few extra calculations to figure out the full answer. Okay, so how can we fix these constants? Well, one way to fix it is to actually use the flat space limit in a quantitative way. So here I just said, well, we could just, knowing what kind of interaction vertex we have, we know the growth of the Mellin amplitudes at large SNT. But you know, if we know what the scattering, flat space scattering amplitude is, we also know the coefficient, so we could input that coefficient. And that would help us fix some of the constants. And the other way that I'll describe is using in the supersymmetric theories that I'll mention, well, in N equal 4 supersymmetric mills, using supersymmetric localization. And, well, okay, it's not obvious. I'll explain this in a bit more detail. It's not obvious why this could possibly work. Okay. So what we've been doing is to apply this procedure in various cases. We applied it in 4D N equal 4 supersymmetric mills, where we looked at the half BPS operators in the CFT, and we got graviton and supergraviton scattering in type 2B string theory. Shai and Eric Perlmutter looked at the 6D 2,0 theory. We looked at the 3D ABJM theory. So ABJM theory has two parameters, N and K. When K equals 1 and 2, it has N equal 8 supersymmetry. And then it has an M theory. Well, if we keep K fixed, it has an M theory dual, so we can get graviton scattering in M theory. We could also look at the ABJM theory in a different limit where we keep N over K fixed, in which case it has a type 2A string theory dual, and then we can get type 2A string theory scattering amplitudes. So these are the various examples that we studied. In this talk, I'll focus on the 4D N equal 4 supersymmetric mills case, because the formulas are a little simpler. On the other hand, there would be an advantage to talk about the ABJM theory because there would be more supersymmetric localization constraints in that case. It would be able to fix more coefficients. But let me talk about the 4D N equal 4 supersymmetric mills case. Okay, so when I say that we get scattering amplitudes in 10D, what do I mean by that? Well, the scattering amplitudes in 10D come from an effective action that takes this form. So at leading order, we have the Einstein-Hilbert term and its supersymmetric completion. And then the correction, the first correction to it, is a certain contraction of four Riemann tensors. And because this has four more derivatives than the Einstein-Hilbert term, there should be a power of the string length to the sixth power. The next term is four derivatives and four Riemann tensors. So this will come with a string length to the 10th power, and so on. Now, the catch is that the terms that have more than two derivatives beyond the Einstein-Hilbert term are not fully known, in the sense that, the specific R to Riemann to the fourth term is known, but its supersymmetric completion isn't. And if we want to figure out how this disorder contributes to CFT correlators, we would really need to know what the supersymmetric completion is. Otherwise, we wouldn't know how to write down. We wouldn't know what Witten diagrams to write down, right, if we don't know the interaction vertices. In flat space, this gives the supersymmetric completion in ADS. The terms that are relevant for ADS scattering are not known. Now, in flat space, this gives a scattering amplitude, which has an expansion in L string times momentum, and also an expansion in G string, the string coupling constant. At leading order in G string, it takes this form. So it starts with 1 over STU, that's the supergravity answer. And then the Riemann to the 4 contribution has the zeta of 3. And then the d to the 4, r to the 4 has the zeta of 5, and so on. So it has an expansion in L string and also an expansion in G string. So this would be the tree level contribution.
So you know the completion in flat space, but not in ABS? Is that the problem?
Yeah. Yeah, so in five space, actually, we know what, at leading order in G string, we know what the full term is. It's in Polchinski, it's some ratio of gamma functions. Okay, and if you expand them, you get something like this. So this can all be described by, and this delta 16q is just, well, it just takes into account the way the amplitudes for different particles are related. So this depends on the helicities of the particles. This can be written like this. So it's just a tree-level supergravity or scattering amplitude times some function of S and T. So the supergravity one is just this, and then the function of S and T starts with a 1 and has an expansion. So this is what it looks like in 10D. In 11D, the effective action is similar, but L string is replaced with L Planck, and there's no G string. And it's only the terms that are up to the order D to the 6, R to the 4 that are known. The reason for that is that they're protected by supersymmetry, and they can be related to some terms in the string theory scattering amplitudes. Okay. So I can also write down the scattering amplitude without expanding in G string. And in that case, so each coefficient would be a function of G string, or more generally, of the complexified string coupling, where chi is the expectation value of the axion, and G string is related to the expectation value of the dilaton. And then this term over here, the term that goes like L string to the 6, is, well, I guess it's missing the L string to the 6. But it's proportional to some modular invariant, which is a non-holomorphic Eisenstein series. So it has this expression. And this one, the one that appears here, is E 3/2. And if we further expand it at small g string, then we get the first term has the zeta of 3. And then there's another perturbative term, and then it has a bunch of non-perturbative corrections. So the finite number of perturbative terms and then an infinite number of non-perturbative corrections. Oh, geez. Okay. So now, okay, so that's the scattering amplitude. Now let's move on to the holographic correlator. And so I said in n equal 4 superangular, so we'll just focus on the simplest operator, which is the scalar, which transforms into 20 prime representation of the SO6R symmetry. So in terms of the scalars of n equal 4 superangulars, which are 6 of them, this would be a trace phi I phi j type operator. So it's quadratic in the scalar, dimension 2 operator. Okay. Now, at large n, large Tuft coupling, this theory is dual to strict theory on ages 5 times S5. The Tuft coupling is related to the radius of ADS divided by the string length, given by it's given the relation given by this formula, and G angles is related to G string. Now, just like the scattering amplitudes, amplitude which had an expansion in G string and L string times momentum, the CFT correlator will also have an expansion in two parameters, which are 1 over n and 1 over lambda. Instead of n, I'll use the central charge C, which is n squared minus 1 divided by 4. So I'll have an expansion in 1 over C and 1 over lambda. And the expansion looks like this. There's some disconnected piece, and there's some 1 over C term that has a further expansion in 1 over lambda, and then 1 over C squared, and 1 over C cubed, and so on. So this is very similar to the expansion that I was showing here. This one here is the contribution from supergravity. This here is the contribution from Riemann to the fourth. This is D to the 4, R to the 4, and so on. So these are all tree level. And then 1 over C squared, this would involve loops, and 1 over C cubed, and so this would be one loop, two loops, and so on. Why is it 1 over lambda to the 3 halves? Well, because this term, if you remember, Riemann to the 4 had 6 more derivatives than the Einstein-Hilbert term. So it came with an L string to the 6th power. Now, L string goes like lambda to the 1/4, so L string to the 6th power would be 1 over lambda to the 3 halves. And similarly, d to the 4r to the 4 would be, this has 10 more derivatives than the Einstein-Hilbert term, so it gives 1 over lambda to the 5 halves. So this is the expansion. And by now, even though the interaction vertices are not fully known, we actually know completely, with the full position dependence and all the constants fixed, all the terms that are highlighted here in colors. Okay. So for this talk, I just wanted to explain the first few. Okay, so two comments. One, can compute this four-point function to the order mentioned, even though the higher order corrections to supergravity are not completely known. I made that point many times. And another thing that I want to mention is that, so for the scattering amplitude, we could consider just an expansion in L string times momentum, where each coefficient is a function of G string. We can do something similar in the n equal 4 superangular theory, where we take a different large n limit, not the usual Tuft limit. We take a limit in which n goes to infinity and g n mills is keep fixed. So this would be, I would call it, the very strong coupling expansion. So in this limit, c is the only parameter, and the coefficients could be functions of g n mills. So it sort of looks like this, and this parallels the expansion of the scattering amplitude with the Eisenstein series that I showed you before. So in particular, this function over here would be related in the flat space limit to an Eisenstein series, or should be. Okay, so let me explain in more detail how the computation goes. But before I do that, I want to point out that these operators S, which are trace of scalar squared, can be generalized. So n equal 4 superangulars contains a whole tower. So their operators go like trace phi to the p with dimension equal to p, and they transform in some representation of SU4. And correlation functions of these operators SP, so these are all half BPS, single trace primaries. Four-point functions of these operators have been studied from the beginning of the ADS-CFT correspondence. And recently, the full four-point function, the full supergravity contribution to this four-point function with arbitrary indices, P, Q, R, S, was written down. In this talk, I won't do arbitrary indices. I'll just focus on trace phi squared and go beyond the supergravity limit. So what does this four-point function look like? Well, the conformal symmetry and the SU4R symmetry, or SO6R symmetry, implies that the four-point function looks like 1 over x12 to the 4, x34 to the 4, that just accounts for the scaling dimensions of the operators, which are equal to 2 each. And then each operator carries SO6 indices, so each of them is a traceless symmetric tensor of SO6. So there should be ways of contracting these indices to get singlets, and there are 6 different ways. And so this contains 6 different functions of U and V. Each function multiplies a specific way of contracting the SO6 indices. Now these functions, these 6 functions, are not independent because they're related by supersymmetry. Supersymmetric word identities imply, in this case, that there are algebraic relations between these 6 functions. The fact that there are algebraic relations is specific to n equal 4 supersymmetry in 4 dimensions. It wouldn't happen in other numbers of dimension. So all these 6 functions can, in fact, be written in terms of a single function, t of u and v. This should remind you of the fact that, as I said before, that a string scattering amplitude can be written in terms of a single function, f of little s and little t. Okay, so roughly, this goes like this. This four-point function is what it would be in a free theory times, I wrote this as a vector, so each entry of the, each row of the vector would correspond to a different way of contracting the SO6 indices. And so they're all multiplied by some function of t of u and v. So if we know this function t, we would know the CFT correlator. So all we have to do is figure out what this function is. Okay, so what I said before is that this is simpler in Mellin space, so one can consider the Mellin transform of this function t, which I'll call m of s and t. And as I said before, m of s and t can be determined up to a few constants using various properties. The properties are crossing symmetry. Well, first of all, crossing symmetry. So it follows from the definition of the function t and also the this relation that m of s and t is the same of m as s and u, and m of s and t is m of u and t. So this function is symmetric under interchanging s, t, and u. It has a given pole structure. When we have an exchange diagram, when we have contact diagrams, this should be a polynomial. And we know the asymptotic growth of this function at large s and t. So at each order in the 1 over lambda expansion, we have higher and higher numbers of derivatives and interaction vertices, so this function should grow as a higher and higher power of s and t. So just this information gives the answer up to a few constants. So this is the supergravity answer. And then the next order should grow. So this one at large s, st, and u goes like 1 over stu. The next term at large stu should go like a constant. So the only option, now because the Riemann to the fourth interaction is a contact interaction, this, the only thing this can be is a constant. But we don't know what constant it is. And next term, it at large stnu should grow like quadratically, and because it's a symmetric polynomial, it should go like s squared plus t squared plus u squared. And there's a constant here, and there's another constant here that we can't determine, and so on. So just these properties determine the correlator up to these, you know, up to this order, up to d to the 4, r to the 4, they determines it up to three constants. So then we can go back to position space, and we get some specific functions of position if we want, in terms of these three constants. So far, these are arbitrary constants. How can we determine them? As I said before, the constraints come either from figuring out the precise relation to the flat space limit, in which case we'd be able to determine at each order, we'd be able to determine the leading coefficient, or from supersymmetric localization, as I'll explain. The flat space limit is easy because I told you all the formula so far. So there's a direct relation between this Mellin amplitude corresponding to the function t of u and v and the function f of s and t that had the zeta functions that appear in the string scattering amplitude, and the relation is given by this. So using this relation, we can figure out what C1 is, it's 15 zeta of 3. We can figure out what C2 is, it's 315 over 4 times zeta of 5, and so on. So just knowing this, we know the correlation function up to this order completely, but we don't know it at order d to the 4 r to the 4. To figure out more terms, we would need more constraints, not just the flat space limit. Okay? So the other constraints in this talk will come from supersymmetric localization. Okay? Now, when describing constraints that come from supersymmetric localization, let me step back a little bit. Supersymmetric localization is a method that gives exact results in supersymmetric theories, but generally it's not for correlation functions of local operators. To explain why it's not for correlation functions of local operators, let me review very briefly how supersymmetric localization works. Okay? So the idea is that we want to compute a partition function, which is a functional integral, and then we deform this partition function by adding the anticommutator of q of something with some coefficient t. This integral is independent of t because of supersymmetry. Now, if the bosonic part of the thing that we added is positive, then we can take t to be very large, and then we can evaluate the integral on the right using a saddle point approximation. In ideal situations, in this limit when t is large, it's just the locus in x where q psi is equal to 0 that would contribute. So this integral, because it's independent of t, this is the exact answer. So what this integral is that an integral over a limited space, which is the x's for which q psi is 0. And then we have e to the s, and then we have a one loop determinant of fluctuations around this locus. So this would be the answer. In ideal situations, this locus where q psi is 0 is finite dimensional. So then we would have start off with an infinite dimensional integral, and using this method in this line, we would have a finite dimensional integral. Okay. And the method also works if we insert any observables that we want. So for instance, we want to compute some correlation functions, but they have to be invariant under the supersymmetry. Now, that's a problem for local operators. Generically, what happens is that the local operator is not invariant under Q. That's just because usually Q squared is a translation, is a linear combination of a translation and an R-symmetry transformation. And because of the translation piece, then Q squared O is not 0. So if Q squared O is not 0, then Q O is also not 0. So this, in general, doesn't work for local operators. So then how can we use supersymmetric localization to fix the constants that we want to fix in our holographic correlator? Well, the answer is we don't use local operators directly. So the supersymmetric observables that we use could be integrated operators, where we don't have this problem. They could still be invariant under Q. Or they could be local operators if they're inserted at points where Q squared is 0. That could happen. But there's a tension between this happening and obtaining a simple answer after we do the supersymmetric localization procedure. If Q squared is always 0, then the theory doesn't localize to a finite dimensional integral. It would localize to an infinite dimensional integral. So in this talk, for figuring out these constants, I will use both options. So I'll relate two of the operators that I want, two of the S2s, to integrated supersymmetric operators. And I'll take the other two and I'll place them at points where Q squared equals 0. Okay. This might get a little too detailed, but Let me try to explain it a little bit. So we start with the n equal 4 superangles theory in flat space, which is what we want to study. It's a conformal field theory, so we can map it to a round 4 sphere. And then we want to insert these operators, so we'll want to deform the theory by inserting some operators. So the idea is to deform it while preserving some supercharge that belongs to an n equal 2 subalgebra of the n equal 4 superalgebra. This is exactly the setup that was considered by Pestun when he did localization for the n equal 4 superangles theory. And in that case, this q squared was 0 only at the north and south poles of the 4 sphere. So the operators that we'll be inserting at points where q squared is equal to 0, those would be one operator we'll put in the north pole, one operator will be at the south pole, and the other two will be integrated over the sphere. And we'll be able to compute the partition function in the presence of sources for these operators. It's actually the same, it's a reinterpretation of the result that Pestun already computed, so we don't have to actually do a supersymmetric localization computation. We can just copy the answer that Pestun had. Okay?
So usually Q squared involves a translation.
Yeah.
Here it's because of the deformation that you're doing that Q squared happens to be 0.
In Pestun's setup, because we're on a 4 sphere, the translation part of Q squared has to vanish somewhere, because otherwise it would just be a vector field on the 4 sphere. So in his setup, it vanished at two points, north pole and south pole.
But I'm wondering whether that's just a coordinate choice, and by choosing a different coordinate, you can define your new pose.
Yeah, it could vanish somewhere else. Yeah, that's right.
So it's a choice made.
It is a choice made by him that this q squared vanishes in the north pole and the south pole. It's a choice that preserves an SO3 rotational symmetry. Okay.
Is there a conversion?
Which integral?
Over the location of the other two operators.
Yeah. You,
But it is two areas, but in general it can be diversion, you take trace of phi.
Yeah, that's right. So because of there is, if you just were to evaluate the integral, you'd say it diverges, but supersymmetry provides a way to regularize it. Okay, so now I can say something. Well, I can try to explain this, you know, a little more abstractly. If we are preserving a supercharge in an n equal two superalgebra, these operators that are either integrated or that are the north pole and the south pole should be some special operators in n equal two supersymmetry. So I want to tell you two different multiplets of n equal two superconformal field theories that will be relevant. One of them is a conserved current multiplet. So if the n equal two superconformal field theory has a flavor symmetry, it will have such a multiplet. N equal four superyang-Mills theory, seen as an n equal two theory, will have extra flavor symmetry, so it will have conserved currents. And this in particular, so it's a multiplet that contains a conserved current, and along with the conserved current, there come different other operators. Like there would be a scalar of dimension two and another scalar of dimension three. You can think about this as a scalar bilinear, like a bosonic mass term, and this of dimension three would be a fermion bilinear, like a fermionic mass term. And another special kind of multiplet is a current multiplet that has some operators that have scaling dimension equal to the U1 R charge. So n equal two theories have SU2 times U1 R symmetry. Now, it's the first kind of multiplet that will be used for integrated operators, and the second kind for operators that are the north pole and the south pole. So the first one, the deformation that inserts these integrated operators is a real mass deformation. So it's like adding some specific mass terms to the scalars and the fermions in the theory. And this would be an integrated linear combination of J and K. And then at the north pole and the south pole, we can put these chiral operators, chiral of the north pole, anti-chiral of the south pole. Now, in n equal four superyang-Mills, we're interested in this 20 prime operator. We can figure out how these operators appear when we think about the 20 prime operator. Well, if we think about how it decomposes under the R-symmetry of n equal two, an n equal two superconformal field theory, it has both this chiral anti-chiral and also this J that appears in the mass deformation. Okay. Now, what Pestun computed was the partition function of n equal four superyang-Mills theory as a function of the coupling and as a function of the mass. So he added this mass deformation. So by taking derivatives with respect to the mass, we can get these integrated operators. Now, it was shown by the people over here that taking derivatives with respect to the coupling constant of the n equal four superyang-Mills theory, brings down an integrated operator, which up to Q exact terms is the same as these chiral operators at the north pole and the south pole. The punchline of this is that it is enough in order to figure out correlation function. We have these two of these integrated operators and one at the north pole and one at the south pole. It is enough to know what the partition function is, a function of the coupling of the masses, which is what Pestun computed. It's a partition function of the n equal two star theory. Just so that you see what it looks like, it's a finite dimensional integral. It's an integral over some variables a sub I goes from 1 to n, restricted so that their sum is 0. And it's just, it's got some Gaussian factor over here. And then it's got some product over I and j of some complicated functions, Barnes double G functions. But, you know, the formulas are given in the Pestun paper. And then there's some contribution from instantons coming precisely from the north pole and the south pole. If Q squared didn't vanish anywhere, then there would be no instantons. But because Q squared vanishes in north pole and south pole, that's where consequently there would be some extra contribution from there. Okay? But perturbatively large n in fixed lambda in the TUF limit one can ignore these instanton contributions, so I'm not going to talk about them. OK? So now, what I said on the previous, so this is what the answer for the S4 partition function is. Now, this method of relating the S4 partition function to correlation functions of operators gives a formula like this. If we take two derivatives with respect to the mass, one derivative with respect to tau, and one with tau bar, tau and tau bar are the complexified gauge couplings, then we get, because of this tau, we get an operator at the north pole, tau bar an operator at the south pole, and m, we get these operators that couple to the mass parameter. Now, in the n equal 4 Supriang Mills case, all these operators can be related to the 20 prime operator. So this whole expression should be, we should be able to write it in terms of the four-point function of the 20 prime operator. The four-point function of the 20 prime operator was written only in terms of one function, t of u and v. Therefore, this must be able to write it in terms of t of u and v. And this is a general formula that doesn't rely on any approximations. And this is the relation. The fourth derivative normalized by the second derivative is given by a two-dimensional integral of this function t of u and v with some weight, which now, for the left-hand side, if we know what Pestun's answer was, so we can try to evaluate it in the limit that we want, which is large n fixed lambda. And if we do that, then we get some expression like this. That's not too complicated. It's a one-dimensional integral. It is a function of lambda. It can then be expanded in 1 over lambda. So this is the constraint. The constraint that we have from supersymmetric localization is that this expression over here is equal to that. Now, for t, we had our expression in terms of the constants, c1, c2, and c3, and so on. So we can just plug this in and evaluate this integral, and then match it to the right, you know, and then we take the right-hand side, we expand it in 1 over lambda, and term by term, we match them. And doing this, we can figure out at each order in 1 over lambda, we have one constraint. So at each order in 1 over lambda, we have one equation. So at first order in 1 over lambda that we can do this, we get what C1 is. It's 15 zeta of 3. This is the same value that we got from the flat space limit. So these are two ways of getting the same number. And the next order, we get some relation on C2 and C3 that together with the relation on the flat space from the flat space limit will allow us to determine what C2 and C3 are completely. OK, so comments. C1 was derived in two ways, one way using the flat space limit, one way using the supersymmetric localization method. And because of that, this is a check of ADS CFT beyond the supergravity approximation. Is it the Riemann to the 4 level? It's quite incredible that one can do this without actually knowing what the reaction is at that order. And we still have a check of ADS CFT. And then combining the flat space limit and localization, we have C2 and C3, and they're both proportional to zeta 5. To go beyond this, to fully fix all the constants, it's higher orders and 1 over lambda, one would, of course, need more constraints. Well, there are potentially more quantities that can be computed using supersymmetric localization, but of course, there isn't an infinite number of quantities that can be computed using supersymmetric localization. So we can go a few more orders beyond this order using this method, but eventually something else, some other information will be needed.
So you comment you can use this to compute things where you might have thought you would have needed the higher order terms in the action. Can you use this to back up the higher order terms in the action?
I don't think so. I think you have one constraint on all possible terms you can write down. Now, writing down the term in the action has many ambiguities.
Right up to Hilbert definitions. Yeah, yeah.
I don't know exactly how. I would assume this comes nowhere close to figuring out what the term in the action is.
We're even getting a coefficient fixed in. Put some constraint on it.
It would put one constraint on it.
Okay.
So just to make sure I understand the bottom sentence.
Yeah.
That means if I go to one higher order, presumably there will be some equation relating C4, C5, and perhaps C6.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
But that's one equation.
Yeah.
And even combined with the flat space limit, we still won't be able to determine all the coefficients at that stage.
That's right. But if you compute some other quantity using supersymmetric localization, not this quantity where you have two derivatives of the coupling and two derivatives with respect to the mass, and you set the mass to zero. For instance, if you compute four derivatives with respect to the mass and then set the mass to zero, then that would be an extra constraint, and perhaps that will help determine C4, C5, and C6. Yeah. And that's exactly right. The next order is three different coefficients to be fixed. Okay. I can mention briefly, I said before that this operator S2, that's trace phi squared, can be generalized to trace phi to the p. This whole method can be generalized to computing S2, S2, SP, SP. I don't want to bother you with the details, but I want to point out that the modification of Pestin's partition function was done in this paper, and this fourth derivative is actually not much more complicated than the one that I showed you for when we had four S2s. Essentially, the only difference is that there's this factor of p over here, and this was a Bessel function 2. Now it's a Bessel function p. So one can also do this and figure out what this four-point function is, and now it depends on p, and it's much more complicated than the one that I showed you before. But one can, again, fully determine it up to this order, 1 over lambda to the 5 halves. Well, one needs a little bit of extra information, but anyway, this is the answer. So now I won't talk about ABGM theory, but I want to spend a couple minutes to talk about this other strong coupling limit, which was the very strong coupling limit. So this so far we worked in the Tuft strong coupling limit, where we sent n to infinity by keeping Jiang null squared times n fixed. But one can consider this other limit where we keep send n to infinity and keep Jiang nulls fixed. So in this limit, the four-point function has an expansion in just 1 over n or 1 over c, where c is the central charge. And the functions could be functions of the of Jiang nulls, or more generally of the complexified gauge coupling tau, which is theta over 2 pi plus 4 pi r over Jiang null squared. So the expansion looks like this. So at first order, there's a supergravity contribution, which is the same as before. Then there's this Riemann to the 4 contribution, which should come with a function of the complexified coupling. Then there's a one loop term. So in this case, at the first few orders, there's a clear distinction between the power of C with which loops appear and the power of C with which tree level Witten diagrams contribute. High orders, the distinction will be lost. So this corresponds to r to the 4, and then there's the next term here that corresponds to d to the 4, r to the 4, and then so on. So one might expect, based on the flat space limit, that this function b of tau here is an Eisenstein series, because the string scattering amplitude had an Eisenstein series. So the flat space limit requires that b of tau is given by this. And I think this is a highly non-trivial fact about the partition function of n equal 4 superangular theory placed on a sphere and deformed by a mass, which is that the second derivative with respect to the mass has this expansion in 1 over c, where at subleading order in 1 over c, there's an Eisenstein series, this e 3 halves. To check this, using supersymmetric localization, would be, is hard, but we're working on it. And this Eisenstein series, where would it come from? It would come from the instanton contributions in the Pestin partition functions, Pestin partition function. Those instanton contributions are given by the Nekrasov partition function, so one would have to understand a Nekrasov partition function. In working with Shai, Michael Green, and Yifan, and Cao Wen on this. And we can reproduce the contribution of the first few instantons from this Pestin partition function.
Wait, question.
Yeah.
Isn't the fact that, you know, let's do anything than equal four m meals enough to tell you that you have the first two terms in all the isothan series?
Well, it should be, but I haven't been able to find a proof.
Right. First of all, I will tell you that tau has to go to 1 over tau, and usually, you know, isothan series to the first three terms.
Yeah.
There's usually, well, the holomorphic ones, it's the non-holomorphic.
Yeah, it should. There should be a proof of this fact, just using the s-duality of n equal 4 Zhu-Bang Mills. We thought about this, but we couldn't figure out how to do it. So then we decided to do the brute force method, where we take Pestin as a partition function, combine it with Nekrasov's results, and then try to expand. But there should be another way. I mean, you know, the higher order terms here are not going to be at some point. They're not going to be Eisenstein series. So it's something special about the first subleading term that gives this Eisenstein series.
So just to make sure I understand the origin of the instantons. So do they come from some space of the saddle point solutions in the localization calculation?
That's exactly right. That's exactly where they come from, because Q squared vanishes there. Then the fields can fluctuate a lot. So one would, right, so the fields in the n equal 4 Zhu-Bang Mills theory localize to constant values everywhere away from those points. Those points you have to glue in some other solution, which is this Nekrasov partition function. That's exactly where it comes from. So Q squared not vanishing really comes at a price. Right, but this is what allows us to insert operators there. Okay, so one can do similar things in ABGM theory. I won't go over this, but you can ask me. So let me conclude. A combination of techniques, supersymmetric localization, supersymmetric word identities, and Lake bootstrap Mellin space can be used to study holographic correlators beyond the supergravity approximation in n equal 4 superangles. And in ABGM theory, even though I didn't talk about it. And here are some future directions. One of them is to explore the other constraints that come from supersymmetric localization, not this particular one that I mentioned. So for instance, one can take the n equal 4 Zhu-Bang Mills theory and put it on a squash sphere, and then take derivatives with respect to the squashing, and then get constraints on other integrated operators. And we're trying to look at that. All I talked about was tree level, so there are of course loops in ADS and loop scattering amplitudes. The one loop contribution to the n equal 4 Zhu-Bang Mills correlator is known completely, but higher ones aren't, and ABGM theory it's not either. And the other one is that, so we had these integrated constraints. So we have the supersymmetric localization answer equal to some integral of this function t of u and v. We used it in this talk in a specific limit, which was the Tuft strong coupling limit, or this very strong coupling limit. But this is a relation that should hold in general. So one future direction is to try to input this in numerical bootstrap studies, or input similar relations in other theories in numerical bootstrap studies. So that's all I wanted to say. Thank you.
Can I go back 2-3 slides?
2-3 slides.
You had a log. Where does that log come from?
This log over here. Where does it come from? I don't have a deep explanation for it. But you know, if you take two other derivatives, two extra derivatives with respect to the coupling, which is what I had before, then the log goes away. So when I had, so the simplest answer, it comes from integrating that equation that I had before.
This term is not holomorphic, right? Because it's not written in, could be not written in terms of log tau, right?
Correct. Yeah. I don't know what it is. I mean, it's a term that appears in the second mass derivative of the S4 partition function. if we didn't take any derivatives with respect to the mass, this would be related to the conformal anomaly. But with two derivatives with respect to the mass, I don't really know what the interpretation is. Yeah.
So you mentioned earlier that you could go to higher orders by taking more derivatives for the partition function, maybe taking two more derivatives with respect to either m or tau.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Would that be a six-point function you would be computing in that case?
That
with
yes. Yeah, that could be a constraint on a six-point function.
Still 2 points at the poles and 4 points.
If two of the derivatives are with respect to tau and tau bar, then yes. If all six derivatives are with respect to the mass, then it's all six integrated operators.
Okay.
But what you could do for a four-point function is to take just four derivatives with respect to the mass, no derivatives with respect to tau or tau bar, and then you have, this would be an integrated four-point function.
And does that put any constraint on C1, C2, C3? You didn't mention that.
I did not mention that because it's much harder to study, so I don't know what the answer is. We're still working on it. Yeah. The reason for that is that when you do this, compute these integrated correlators, there are divergences that you have to regularize in a supersymmetry preserving way. It's a little tricky.
But this anomaly that usually this local G in supersymmetric emils appears starting, say, for example, from the second loop. It's conformal anomaly, you can say, or whatever, some anomaly. But so in this way, your expression starts from this, right? So in terms of comparison with the number of loops, you see what I'm trying to understand?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That
this local G, it appears that, you know, usually you can say this higher terms in beta function.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't really know what to say about it. I mean, another thing that I should say about it is that this is an expansion at large C, so it's the leading term at large C that has this log. If you were to look at the full holographic correlator, I'm not sure the log would be there. It could also be a large artifact of large N, but I'm not sure.
Okay, yeah, I think we're probably out of time, but before, we'll go for dinner, so we'll meet at Broida at 6 p.m. And thanks, Silvio.